Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me. I'm not sure I deserve the to be given the keynote slot. I was looking at all the other speakers, thinking, my God, they know a great deal more about this than I do. So I'm not going to make an environmental case. I want to do two different things. I want to try and tease out why, just following that introduction, we're on the back foot. The last 5 years have seen an intensification of the green movement worldwide being put on the back foot. After Copenhagen, it's got no better, and it's got a lot worse, as everybody knows. Why? When the case, in many respects, is getting more urgent, and actually publics around the world are more keenly aware, I think, now than they were even 10 years ago, of the variability in climate, if not of global warming. Very concerned about resource depletion and what it means for them. And yet that is not connected with the debate in the public realm. And then I want to try and see if there are any answers and to tell you now up front what I think the answer is. I do think that too much political argument is disconnected in 2013, certainly on the centre and centre-left. If you want to make the case for higher wages and stronger trade unions, that's a very siloed argument. You want to make the argument for responsible capitalism, which is one of my kind of causes, as many of you know, close to my heart. I call it stakeholder capitalism. That's siloed. And then there's the green movement, which is siloed. It'd be so much more effective if there was a kind of common intellectual thread between those three positions, and if more common cause was made, and if it was understood and that that was an integrated approach to how one views the world, and supported by some killer lines and killer cells, rather as the right have manufactured some killer cells for their position. But to begin at the beginning, I mean, what's going on? I do think that it's complicated what the roots of this are, but there is a decline in enlightenment values or belief in enlightenment values. There's a decline in belief in scientific evidence. A decline in belief, actually, of the value of impartial debate within a public realm, or even the idea of publicness. Evidence, science, daring to know, the public realm, exchange of ideas in the public realm. All of this has been in retreat now for some years. I think it's crystallized in the climate change skeptics. I think it's also there in Euroscepticism. But I think it's also there, actually, in actually many of the arguments we have about many people believe that they're living in a more violent country when actually we know that actually crime is falling. And I think the why enlightenment values are in retreat is actually... it's to do, I think, with the kind of postmodern view that there is no such thing as truth, only partisan views of reality, a view that you have to respect all points of view as equally valid, on the right a view that actually if science produces uncomfortable answers, then the science must be wrong. I think that's some of the papers, and particularly I think of Nigel Lawson, and what he's been doing, it is really to deny evidence because it produces the uncomfortable conclusion that some form of collective action is required, both within a country and between countries. Climate change socialism, as it's depicted in the Anglo-Saxon Rite, has been seen as a backdoor way of re-legitimizing the ghost of 20th century socialism in all its, as they would say, ghastliness. and must be resisted to the last. Now, I think that actually the retreat from Enlightenment values on the Anglo-Saxon right is something of a crisis for the right. I think there's lots of reasons why the Republicans have lost 5 of the last 6 presidential elections. But actually, the retreat from Enlightenment values on the American right is part of the story. America remains just about an Enlightenment republic, and you can't actually make the case of Tea Party politicians without actually there being, even in the States, actually, where there's a lot of credulity, particularly about faith and religion, you still can't get away with some of the things that are said, which are plainly, you know, not in the tradition of reason. And I think the same is true of the British right. We're watching, I think, an emergent first order crisis of ideas on the right. Once you start giving way to the view that actually, if the evidence says you should ABC, but actually that means that you've got to do something collective or public, and therefore that can't be done, you find yourself doing wrong things and actually consistently losing elections. So there's that as part of the kind of background to the decline of, you know, it's harder, and it wasn't helped by events in East Anglia, the University of East Anglia. It's harder to make a case based on science than it was even 10 years ago. And then there's another thing, which is the evolution of the modern media, where, again, a combination of postmodernism, a view that actually all truths are in the eye of the beholder, has led to a confusion of news and comment in the way our papers are edited and presented. So actually, what priority you give to news stories and how they're written has to mesh with the objectives of the editor and his her proprietor in what kind of cultural and political impact they want the paper to have. That's always been the case. I mean, proprietors have never owned papers because they're disinterested observers of the political scene. But it's become more acute in 2013 than ever. And I find the resistance of the 4 centre-right newspaper titles, or I should say groups, to the Levinson proposals, arguing that actually that is brings the spectre of Mugabe-type state control of the media into Britain, not recognising that actually you can have precisely the same thing, but privatised Mugabe, which is what they do day by day, is one of the kind of comic moments, actually, in contemporary discourse. But it's there, and actually I'm very struck how, and I was talking to an ex-journalist on the right, actually, a very prominent ex-journalist on the right, used to work, well, actually where he worked, but he was saying one of the reasons why he left the particular group, and you'd all know his name, was that actually he got, he just couldn't go on having to go through successive government reports or whatever it might be, always looking for the one thing that actually one could nose off the story that would actually show the other side, nearly always the left, to their disadvantage. And it was polluting and degrading of the craft of journalism. That's where we are in 2013, and I don't think any remedy is likely. So those big things are the background to which one makes this argument. But it also has to be said that actually I don't think that the Green Movement has actually helped itself much. And we all know that despite the rise in carbon in the atmosphere, that actually the projected rise in global warming in the last 15 years has not proved to be as linear as we thought 15 years ago. And there's also, I think, in order to kind of terrorize people into action, there's been too much willingness, I think, to rank kind of all environmental menace as co-equally menacing. So the decline of biodiversity, desertification, global warming, climate volatility, resource pressure of whatever type, genetically modified foods, are all presented co-equally as a menace. And here I think we make the same mistake as our enemies in that we're not being forensic enough about how we rank these threats and how if we are going to play the Enlightenment scientific card, to dare to know, to deploy reason, to care about how we steward our resources, accept our responsibilities to ourselves and our kids, to want to live well by that compass, then we have to practice what we preach. And that hasn't been done sufficiently, in my view. So I think that all of that adds up to, give or take, the situation in which we find ourselves. And it's a very dangerous situation. And again, in this audience, I don't need to make that point, to overstress it. When I wrote The State We're In, which is the 20th anniversary, comes up in 18 months' time, a lot of my friends in the Green movement were critical of me because I had consecrated in a 250-page book of 100,000 words, probably no more than 500 to 1,000 words on green issues. And I'm keenly aware that that was a fault of mine. But actually, over the last 20 years, I've got better educated. And actually, some of the some of what's going on kind of is wholly alarming. And the article that led to my being invited to this, which some of you will know this work, but Carbon Trust produced a very interesting paper showing how the value of the world's resource companies, oil and mining companies, that the capitalization of them presumed that they would exploit all the resources that they had. But if that was true, that would imply that so much carbon was going to be burnt that actually there would be, that all the global environmental targets and limits would be massively broached. So either there was a colossal mispricing in the stock markets because the stock markets weren't aware that these resources couldn't be burnt, or the stock market was right. How could it be, that stock markets are making such a colossal mistake as along with those of us in the West, and what are you going to do to put it right? Well, I mean, here I come to what I think we have to do. And I do think that actually in 2013, and we've reached the end of the road in two important kind of Enlightenment traditions, thinking about what the good economy in society is. One tradition, which handed down to us from the left, of scientific socialism, was that actually the answer to the what is a good economy in society is that we will use science and planning, we will socialize, we will nationalize, we will organize, we will do it that way. And huge mistakes were made in the 20th century in the name of that tradition, as we all know. And nobody can stand in front of an audience in 2013 and I think and argue that scientific socialism within that tradition, which is a direct descendant of the Enlightenment, is the answer to the crisis of capitalism now. And there's another kind of stream of thinking that comes out of the Enlightenment, which is, I guess, free market economics, the descendants of Adam Smith, who actually said the best form of economy and society is one that is actually wholly self-organizing around individual and preoccupations and incentives. It will find its own way to the best outcome. And again, we know that is absolutely not the right answer to the exam question. And I think that the Enlightenment offers a different set of actually precepts to the exam question, what is a good economy in society? It is one which actually recognizes the codependence of public and private, the necessity of many runners and riders, lots of experimentation in a good society, but above all, actually, mutual obligation. mutual obligation between people who are equal before the law. And that leads you to, in my view, responsible, what you call responsible capitalism, what I call stakeholder capitalism, that actually you can't do a good capitalism without two or three fundamental things being respected. One is that a good capitalism takes place in an environment where the public and the private are recognised to be codependent, and that public action, far from being seen as the enemy of the peace, is seen as the vital precondition for experimentation, for innovation, and for solving collective action problems, one of which, of course, is what's happening to our environment. But another is, of course, how you innovate at the technological frontier. Another is how you get productivity gains. All these things are interrelated. There's a codependency between public and private. Another is the notion of stewardship, that actually individuals are embedded, Rousseau-like, in society. That actually an owner of an enterprise does not have kind of John Lockean-type autonomy over all he or she surveys, and devil take the hindmost, and I'll do with my assets what I like. And if it causes environmental damage, too bad. If it creates atomistic, rootless workplaces, because I want to employ the people who work in my assets as I choose, around, and I don't want to recognise trade unions or their collective voice, that is not equally a kind of value system that actually holds. The heart of stakeholder capitalism is owners who accept that they have responsibilities to their assets, because it is a privilege to trade in a society, and there is a codependence between a successful enterprise and a successful society. Actually, that you should only be able to incorporate if you declare what you're going to do. Right up until the end of the 19th century, you could only incorporate a company in Britain and America if you declare what its purpose was. My purpose is to build great buildings. My purpose is to build canals. My purpose is to brew great beer. My purpose is, if I found the East India Company, to trade in the Indies and carry everything on in British boats. Maybe a narrowed purpose, but it's a purpose. The notion that the object of an enterprise is only to maximise shareholder value in a network of transactions that can be permanently renegotiated and discarded as the market dictates would have been seen by the founders of the idea of the company, which has its origins in the notion companion, which companions come together to share risk, as utterly barbaric. So, stakeholder capitalism, the heart of it is the notion of owners who accept stewardship obligations and declare their purpose and accept reciprocal obligations to the society of which they are part. Now, I want to see Ed Miliband and the Labour cabinet over the next 18 months working this up into a feasible strategy. I want to see them putting company law reform and actually the reform of the financial system in which such ideas could only flourish needs to be reframed. And I also want them to see embracing the notion, a second notion, and you'll see how this relates to your own agenda in about 2 minutes, so bear with me. I also want to see them embracing the notion of that with our backs against the wall, GDP in 2018 in Britain will be 16% below where it would have been had there been no financial crisis. That is the worst shock to our economy outside wartime ever. That actually there's no rescue in sight from a credit boom, North Sea oil or anything else. We have to innovate and invest our way out of this crisis. We are 159th in the world league table for investments proportion of GDP. We're even lower in the innovation landscape. To innovate well in the 21st century means you have to accept you don't know all the answers, that there's so many risks out there, making a mistake, so many scientific and technological possibilities. You have to collaborate with others. Open innovation, I chair something called the Big Innovation Centre, has become the new business strategy for the more progressive British companies, all of whom, by the way, would also describe themselves as green companies. So that, for example, one of the leaders in open innovation in Britain, with a cadre of executives they call open innovation orchestrators, is Unilever, who are also, as you know, take sustainability pretty damn seriously too. If you're going to do stakeholder capitalism, if you're going to be open innovators, if you're going to take stewardship seriously, if you're going to set the obligation of society of which you are part, it's absolutely clear where the environmental argument sits. It sits absolutely housed in that larger story. It means that the Green Movement makes common cause with those who want to reform company law, and also those who also think that actually if the wage share in Britain was the same as it was in 1980, around 57-58% of GDP rather than 52% of GDP, average wages in Britain would be £7,000 higher than they currently are. The average wage in Britain is about £23,000 a year. If the wage share was what it was in 1980, the average wage would be £30,000 a year. And the idea that actually, you know, deregulating the labour market, abandoning free collective bargaining, and regarding trade unions as monsters has actually done anyone any good is risible. But actually, we have to reinvent the union movement too. And reinventing the union movement, it seems to me, is also part of this same narrative. So for me, you know, you're having green labour, and you're spending your summer conferences consecrated to green issues. But I guess what I would like you all to hold in mind as you debate during the day about how to make is that actually there's a family of arguments and a family of propositions that we have to integrate and put together. And they have their roots in what I would argue kind of true Enlightenment values of codependence between public and private, the understanding you need a public realm as well as a private realm. You need pluralism and experimentation. And also you have to understand that science is itself a process of experimentation and doesn't provide one truth. It's a process. But let's actually have institutions which capture that. Lastly, I think all this has to be housed. For me, I think we have to get much better in actually how we sell this. I've been very struck in my encounters with the right, and I have many of them, is that actually, you know, they're able to frame it in one simple phrase. I was very impressed by Daniel Kahneman's book, Slow Thinking, Fast Thinking. Too many propositions on the left are slow thinking. You have to have a syllogism to get to them. Have to sit back and think. People don't actually think like that, Kahneman argues. They actually need reflex, intuitive triggers to thought and to action. Otherwise, you can't get through the day. We all rely on intuition and immediate, fast reactions. And so when you're told that inheritance tax is a death tax, you think your instinct reaction is, yeah, that's right, inheritance tax, death tax, don't like it. But actually, the notion that inheritance tax is a death tax is risible. Of course, it's a life tax. It's a tax, it's what we share in someone's luck they haven't earned in getting resources from their parents, which they did nothing to do to be born to those parents. The idea it's a death tax, a tax on the person that's dead, is absolutely risible. But how effective that's been in actually discrediting the notion of inheritance tax. We need similar phrases and lines to kind of hit back at those who are describing us as climate change socialists. I would argue that Nigel Lawson is the champion of death policies, for example. I would argue that there is nothing more rank and foul than burning excessive carbon. You know, we need to find adjectives and lines that actually drive home actually the mortal risks that we're running in actually business as usual. And again, to the final postscript, I've been a long-time admirer, as many of you know, of the German and Nordic economies. In fact, when I first published The State We're In, I got a lot of fun was at my expense because I thought that Germany would be the strongest economy in Europe in 2010. And this was the subject of much mockery in The Economist and The Sunday Times and goodness knows where. It was proof positive that Will was a maverick who, you know, nice chap, but knew nothing about economics. But one of the things that I've been very struck by the Germans is actually they don't take the view, the reflex view that we do in Britain, that actually all forms of regulation are necessarily bad. We can't get out of this crisis, it seems to me, without some codependence of public and private, some forms of public intervention, and some forms of regulation. Regulation is a form of public action, and actually, if you regulate well, the strength of the German car industry is because they took seriously, the Green Movement got stuck in there in the early 90s, and actually insisted on catalytic converters and highly efficient engines, which actually have become the passport of the Germans into the Chinese motor industry and into the 21st century kind of boom. Regulation is the handmaiden of that, not the enemy of that. And it's part of this story that I think we just start telling. But look, I've overstayed my welcome. Thank you very much. I'll be very happy to take any questions. Thank you.